This is Laura Cameron Fraser, Jung's Treatment of Christianity, October 26, 1985, Tape 2 of 4.
Once he emerges to torment souls, but when he gets down there, he says, this is exactly the right place for me. It's described as being very barren, but he says, this is my rightful home. I don't want to be someplace where I can't think for myself and where I don't belong to myself. This is the proper place for a person who has his own thoughts and who belongs to himself. It's a marvelous statement. And I see in Milton's devil the individuating ego. I think that's exactly what the individuating ego does. It goes to a rather barren place, granted, but it's its own space and it thinks for itself. And the picture of Michael in heaven, I hate to say this, is absolutely uninteresting. Because Michael is only obedient. I mean, that's his only attribute. It's not interesting at all. So, you know, Jung is onto something here, that it's only as you get these two together. And of course, aside from the question of who Jesus really was, the conventional picture of Jesus isn't all that interesting either. So, there it is, that these two have to come together and become one reality and endure one another and eventually embrace one another and become one reality, and man is hanging there, in a sense, between two thieves, enduring. And, you know, I don't know, maybe they're both thieves. Well, now that's all very good. I mean, something very profound, you know, just saying there, you know, I haven't encountered anywhere else the idea that the devil is to be redeemed, although my father was not a student of Jung, so far as I know, he was unaware of that whole body of literature, but he used to say that, you know, if there was such a creature as the devil, and then he would say, you know, there's really no reason why there couldn't be, then he would certainly have to be redeemable. But anyway, this is all very good as far as it goes. But I don't see that the incompleteness that Jung is talking about is remedied except in the one dimension of the demonic. The lack of the feminine and the lack of the material is still there. Although you could argue that in this struggle, that the material might come into it. But it's not explicitly there. I mean, these are both metaphysical figures. So, if you've taken that in, I want to take this one off. Is that there was a lot of talk in Jung about the fourth. But I have to admit that when I think it through for myself, I come back to a trinity, which I will now show you my trinity. Said, logically, This source should be feminine rather than masculine, because the pattern of nature is that life comes forth from the mother. Well, that of course was the prevailing image of the matriarchal period, the mother with the child, and that was that movement shown. Then, of course, when patriarchy came along, it substituted the father for the mother. I think if we just simply look at human life and the way it's made, we can see that it can't be either one. It has to be both. But it is interesting that the source, just looked at archetypally now, let's reflect on that for a moment. Jung's Trinity showed the father, or the source, and then the ego. Now the ego, archetypally, is masculine. You see that the issue from the unconscious is consciousness, and because of its necessity to differentiate itself from the unconscious, which is signified as the Great Mother, then it becomes a son. And so in the dreams of individuated persons, you always see this male child, first an infant, then a young child, then a youth, then a man, and so forth. Developing consciousness seemed always to be signified as a male figure. So this is interesting, because if we look at this archetypally, this source should be feminine. But that's unsatisfactory, because if it's an unconscious totality, it obviously has got to represent both poles. And out of the archetypally feminine unconscious, there does emerge the archetypes of father and mother, and then many other archetypes as well. So, in my Trinity, they're both there. We have the incarnation. Now, the incarnation is not Jesus. The incarnation is creation. Jesus, of course, is a part of the incarnation, a particularly conscious aspect of it. Son, daughter, must contend with the opposites of the material and the spiritual and the good and the evil. So they're all there in that pool. And then, over here, we have the self. Now the self images itself in a male person as male, and in a female person as female. And spirit, of course, is neither one. I remember Jesus saying, in heaven they are neither given nor taken in marriage. Now the psyche is whole. So it's neither male nor female. And so we have father, mother here, an unconscious totality, expressing out of itself, giving birth out of itself, discovering its own being through its creation, incarnating in that creation, and the polarities of male and female, of material and spiritual, and good and evil, are expressed in that creation. This, just as Jung says, I like this movement very much, that the development of relationship between these two gives birth to the third, which is the self or spirit.
Could you say a little more about creation? Are you referring to the dawn of consciousness?
About creation, what?
Historically, would you say that's the dawn of consciousness in man?
I'm not getting that word. The word of man.
Is creation the dawn of consciousness?
Or the dawn of consciousness in man?
Yes.
Her question is, did you mean all, that creation equaled all life?
Yes. All of created life. Yeah. Jung thought that God required his creation to become conscious of himself. My father used to refer to the created world as the unconscious body of God, which is quite a neat expression, actually. And I think there's something there. But the development of man as on this planet, the highest expression of life here in terms of consciousness, is an expression of a form of life that becomes aware of itself. And in becoming aware of itself, of course, it becomes aware of God. What it is an expression of God. And so God is looking into the mirror of himself and his own creation. And he's a totality. She is a totality. And this totality flows into the creation. Man, as a part of that, sees certain aspects of his experience which are beneficial for him, and he calls those good. And there are certain aspects of his experience that are not beneficial to him, and he calls those evil. And he somehow gradually has to become aware that both simply represent aspects of God, and he has to endure the tension of that. It's no small task, and suffering is entailed in it. The individual who at a certain stage in development has a very clear picture of what is good and what is evil, and virtuously excludes what is evil and all persons who appear to partake of that, well, leads a remarkably contented life for a time. Did my comments answer your question, or am I hitting where you are?
Yes, I think you answered.
All right.
I think you said yes.
Okay. Well, that's my Trinity. And I couldn't see a way to make a fraternity out of it. Because it seems to me to be artificial to split one of the three movements of the Trinity into its opposites, unless you were going to deal with the other opposites also. It seems to me that I couldn't figure out a way to make that work. So, this is Jung's unmodified. My elaboration of his Trinity depicting the process of individuation. And I think that my elaboration of it solves the problems that he describes, but in a little different way than he did. Well, so that's the question of the Trinity. And here again, the same point applies as with the other points that I've made, that in this development, you have to live through the symbols, not just disregarding them or cutting them off. That every gain that's made has to be kept. One must move on from there. So it's an increasingly inclusive growth line. Now, why don't we take a break now, and then why don't we take 10 minutes, and then come back and throw out. We're going to break for lunch at 12:30, and we're going to take 1 hour. I hope that's all right with you, that we'll just return then at 1:30.
That won't mean you'll have to go over 3 months.
Pardon?
That won't mean if we take a whole hour, you'll have to go on past 3 o'clock.
No. I'll stop at 3, but I just thought that you would rather have that time to work here rather than take an hour and a half for lunch. Am I right? Yes. Okay.
What I meant was if she wanted to give us less time for lunch, that was all right.
Yes.
I didn't mean if I wanted more. I meant I don't care what you're
asking. No, thank you. That's all right. I want to just pick up some of your questions. Some of the questions I felt were answered by the discussion this morning, but some of these are not. This question I'm not quite clear about. Jung and the Holy Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, sacrifice of his only Son? ? Now, I think we might have answered this. Let me just make a comment on it. Jung felt strongly the violation of individual psychic life in designating in the liturgy of the Eucharist that all that it is about is the suffering of Jesus Christ. He felt that that largely sterilized it for most people, that its universal meaning was the universal suffering that the individual undergoes in the movement from an ego-oriented life to one with a strong axis between ego and self, with self in the authoritative position. And so, you know, I hope that this is answered, but if it's not, come up and clarify it with me, and I'll deal with it in the afternoon. Is literature a suitable substitute for religion or psychology? That is, did Jung go to church? I don't know whether he went to church. I'm rather doubtful that he did. Does anybody know more about that than I do? I don't think he did. Churches and their teachings were pretty important for Jung. As you know, he's several generations back, there were ministers in his family, and he grew up a PK. So it was very much in his psyche and in his concern. But I think he did not go to church. I don't think literature is a suitable substitute for religion, although literature is
is often religion. That is to say, it's often very profound and concerned with the very values that religion is. But I don't think it's a substitute for the rights of the church. Now, the rights of the church, as we have discussed in the previous hour, have often become sterilized by much too rigid an interpretation of their meaning. But if they are understood in the universal way that is possible, they can be so important. The sacramental life of the church, I think, is very important. I find in my church, in spite of the fact that most people do not understand what is happening in the Eucharist, I think that's a fact, that most people don't grasp it. At the same time, they're touched by it. It's quite clear that something numinous is happening. And when one looks at Jung's interpretation of that rite, one can become aware of what it is. If the individual is buying into the interpretation that it is only about Jesus' movement, the fact is that Jesus' movement was archetypical for man, and that therefore it does have a certain power, even if lived out in that narrow interpretation. So, I think that communal worship does have a place. It is difficult to find a community where people are really growing and questioning and enlarging in mind. It's not impossible. Could you tell me your name again? Nancy was telling me during the break of some exciting developments going on in the Roman Catholic Church. There is movement in the churches. There is growth taking place. Do you want to say just a word about the incarnational theology that?
Christ became human. This tells us that God is present in creation, and that a way to come to know God is through creation. So through the material world, we come to know God through our own inner being, where God is. That the idea that to be a human being means to have a part of God within you. That's basic. It's really
exciting, though. Yes. It's interesting about the Catholic Church, as solidly as authoritarian as it is, yet any real movement of growth that's going on in the world is to be found also in that church. Yeah. Always I find that there's always that development. Uh-huh. I think church has a place, an important place, as I have suggested, in the rites, because it's one of the places present in our world where a symbolic representation is still available. Do you realize how impoverished our lives are, symbolically speaking, today? You know, we just... We have moved away from the symbolic life in so many aspects. And things like our Easter symbols, you know, the Easter bunnies and what goes on at Halloween and everything, does tend to be quite flattened in the modern world. So in the church, you have available some profound symbols. And there is nothing stopping any individual from experiencing those profoundly, regardless of how the people around you are interpreting them. I must say that it's more difficult in an environment that is quite literalistic or quite legalistic. And so the likes of you would do well to look for a church that has a respect for symbolic rites, and yet it has an intelligence working in its midst, a yeast working in the loaf, so to speak. I don't know if any of you have ever discovered the novels of Marie Corelli. Is there anybody here that's ever read them? She's a novelist of many decades ago now. She wrote Romance of Two Worlds and Barabbas and The Master Christian. She writes very profoundly. She's what I'd have to call an esoteric Christian of maybe 70 years ago. Yeah, her these are novels that she wrote, but they're beautiful. Speaking of literature that is akin to religion. But in the end, it seems to me that this is in the end of Romance of Two Worlds. There's a discussion between two of her characters about where they will go to church, where they would seek out a source of spiritual enlightenment. And one of them says to the other, it's been a long time since I've read this, so I'm calling it back from memory that's a bit cobwebbed now. But one of them says to the other, I would look for the churches where there is available a kind of electrical energy. It's a kind of transformational energy. And that's all that was said, but it seemed obvious to me that it was a reference to the liturgical churches where the Eucharist is celebrated. And there was a reference to a kind of spiritual energy involved in that. And I think that's true. And I occasionally find myself talking with people who have worked their way through their intelligence right out of being able to buy into a conventionally oriented church, but yet they have gone to churches where a sense of the profound is still available, where there's some awe in worship, and they've experienced God there. You know, it is true that when you have human beings together focusing upon God, that there's a power in that kind of experience. So that's all I can say, that I think that there is a place for church in our lives, that in spite of all the inadequacies and all the stupidities and all the stuff that's got to be enlarged.
Lauren, can I ask why you're right on that subject? Do you think that the modernization of liturgical language in the last 20 years has made worship and the symbols more accessible to people, or has it not really helped one way or another? The modernization of language, has it really helped in worship to make symbolism more real?
Yes. Language is a big problem in the whole question of liturgy. I was just telling this gentleman here in the break that I've come to the resolve that I'm going to write a new liturgy. I think it just has to be done. Our church has just accepted a new prayer book, as you know, David. When? 79. Was that the final acceptance of it? I don't know. But it was, you know, the changes that it made were good. They offended many people, but they were good changes. But it doesn't begin to go far enough. So now I think a really new liturgy needs to be written that begins with this kind of thinking and Jung's thinking in the individuational process. And Jesus, of course, is an excellent mediator of that if he is understood to be who he was, a representative human being. The Anthropos, not the only son. So we've got a lot of work to do on this question of language. Well, now, let me see. Please discuss the idea of evil as the shadow of God. Now, I don't think that evil is the shadow of God. We talked about God as an unconscious totality. God may be more than an unconscious totality, but that's an aspect of God. This is a description of a human being where consciousness has excluded some material, and therefore a shadow develops. But you don't have a shadow where you don't have consciousness. And one of our premises here is that God is seeking consciousness of himself through his creation. So God doesn't have a shadow. He perhaps creates man so that he develops a shadow, but it's in man, you see. So God is not a mirror of man. Any comment on that? You know, that's kind of a loaded statement, I know, because we have for so long had the idea that God is perfect light, perfect consciousness, perfect good. And therefore we had all this problem as to what we were going to do with with everything else. And indeed, you know, if you think of God in that manner, there isn't a whole lot of point in the whole creational process, actually. Is that if you're just perfect and everything is fully realized in you, where is there to go? You know, life is a process in which God has some stake. I think the old theology said that, well, God didn't really have a stake because he was perfect in himself, but he created us to enjoy. Well, that's not bad. That's actually pretty good. It's better than some theological statements I've heard, but but it isn't sufficient. There's an interconnection between God and his creation that's deeper than that. Deeper than an all complete perfect God who simply has this sort of dallies with this creation. There's too much suffering in his creation to be explained by that kind of picture, I believe. What we have to see is that God is in the midst of this with us. God is us. And we are God. There is nothing else but God. We are individualizations of God, and our suffering is God's suffering, and God's suffering is ours. You know, it finally comes down to that. And so, in a sense, our shadow is God's, if it's looked at that way. But evil is not as such the shadow sign of God. Evil is, as we experience evil, it is that part which we have rejected and which therefore returns to us in some other part of our body. Now, you know, looked at in a large sense, look at us sitting here in a circle today. There's a mandala right here today. We are, in a sense, all parts of each other, if it comes right down to it. We're all parts of the same self. And so, looking at that idea, which is the basic premise of mysticism, isn't it? If you look at that, then suppose that I think that you are evil in some way, or you think that I am evil in some way, what we will have to do with that is that you or I, as the case may be, are a part of your infinite self. You are a part of my infinite self. And I'm going to have to deal with you as a part of myself, therefore. And so it's not going to do me a whole lot of good to say, your rubbish, trash, and put you outside of my line of consciousness, sooner or later, my line of consciousness is going to have to expand to include you, and I'm going to have to own you and love you. You're going to have to do the same with me. Now, there's another question here. Why should I continue with Sunday liturgy involved when it is so much less helpful than my meditation and life involvements and spiritual reading? Where in the church do I belong? Where can my girls and I go to Mass and celebrate, participate in your Trinity? Jung had a very profound thought, I think, and a very true one. He thought that every individual had a solemn obligation to the totality to undergo individuation, and that that was all the individual could do. That he could become whole in himself. Of course, in doing that, your life touches many people, and you do the work that you have to do as an individuating self. All that is involved. But he felt that every person can substantially help the world by becoming a whole self. And therefore, if you find a church that is near as you can make it fits where you are, and churches do differ in their general level of consciousness, that depends in part on where the congregation is and in part where the minister is. But now, doing the best that you can with that equation and recognizing that there's no perfect church, when you find where you'd like to worship, then focus on being as whole a self as you can where you are. And I don't think that any of us have to just passively accept things the way they are. My decision, for example, to write a new liturgy is a part of my action to not simply be passive about it. You know, that's a contribution I can make. And the particular liturgy that I write may never go anywhere, but it might stimulate somebody else to think, yes, another liturgy does have to be written. The effort could go from there. That would be my answer to this question, that you try where you are to make the symbols more inclusive. The whole question of language and religion is difficult. I don't know quite what the answer is on this. Is that we go back to this. It's somewhat cumbersome to refer to the Father, Mother, God each time. I know people who refer to the Creator. Well, that's okay, but it doesn't convey what parent does. Parent is kind of impersonal. You come back to Father, Mother. It's difficult, isn't it? It's a hard problem. And, an inclusive word for man is difficult to come by. So we have some struggling and some growing to do here. But I've come to see that it's important as a lady priest. After I'm smiling because a number of my congregation refer to me as the lady priest. But I have done quite well in just accepting language where it is and understanding it in a generic and inclusive sense. But now, at this hour in my development, I'm becoming aware of what it's doing to consciousness to experience these exclusions and limitations. And it's not good. It's not good. It's no better for men than it is for women. You know, it is damaging for women to have an exclusion of their symbols from their religious life, but it's just as bad for men. As you know, maybe not quite as bad, for the reason that the ego-strengthening images for a man are more present than for a woman. But it is difficult for a man in as much as his complement is missing. So we have to do something about it. Not just in our understanding, but in our language. But just exactly what? No. Obviously, I'll be struggling with that if I do a new liturgy. Is the path of individuation hindered by the Christian Church or most Christian denominations as they practice today? To some extent, yes. To some extent, it is hindered. It both helps and it hinders, and that's where you have to sort it out. Where it helps is that the Church does successfully deal with the unconscious in ways that may be difficult to find elsewhere. You know, there is a mediation of the unconscious in the Church that's important. And Jung found that some people who came to him for treatment who were successfully connected to their churches were best simply returned to their churches. You know, he sometimes did that rather than taking the alternative of offering analysis. That when the Church was really working in its connection for that individual, unless there was some sickness that was deeply established there, he tried to work through the organizations of religion. But where it hinders is in one way we've already mentioned, by appropriating the Christian myth as an exclusive property of the one and only Son of God, rather than as the universal path of man. People can fixate on that figure and project all their good onto him. I know there are people in my church who think, oh, you just gotta relax into God and he just does it for you. You know, you just let go and just let him take it. A completely passive stance. That won't do. You know, there are places where we do have to relax into God. Well, that is one of the things that we have to learn. But we can't just hand our persons and our lives over to God and say, okay, kid, it's all yours. a totally passive stance will result in a continuing unconsciousness on our part. Of course, life will not let us get by with that, and then it'll drop us into one mess after another until we change our stance. But the Church has not sufficiently brought home to people that each person's journey is his or her own, and that Christ's journey is an archetypical one, which must be experienced in the movement of one's own psyche, or it's nothing. You know, as Eckhart said, what is Christ's birth to me if he's not born within me? Quite right. Exactly right. It's exactly nothing to you unless he actually is born within you. So both hinders and helps, but fortunately, it is in our own hands to decide how that equation works, because we can, through our own consciousness, definitely tilt that toward the helping side. and we can help to lift the consciousness of those around us in that. I think that the one thing I haven't mentioned is that a community of faith is important. It's an enlarged family in a way. And family life is important. We all have family life, whether we live alone or not. I live alone, but I have two families. I have people that I'm related to, and I have the family of my church. Of the two, the family of my church is vastly more important because it's where I spend a lot more of my time. My relatives are scattered here and there, you know, and our lives often don't connect that much. But this family of the church is my growing edge. I was dealing with a man in church once. He was a very judgmental individual. And we had returned from the vestry retreat, and he was quite offended by the fact that one of the men there had used what he regarded as vulgar language. And he was also offended that alcohol had been drunk. Mind you, there was no instance at the retreat of abuse of alcohol. You know, there was really nothing to be offended about, but he felt that nothing stronger than wine should be drunk, for example. And he came to my office, and his entire purpose of visiting me was not to discuss the matter. He simply wished my support in his judgments and denunciations. And when this was not forthcoming from me, even before he got up and walked out, I could feel that movement taking place within him. I knew he was going to get up and walk out. And I said, please don't do that. Please stay and we will discuss the matter. But he did, in fact, get up and walk out. Whereupon I got up and walked out also. I walked out of my office, straight over to the church, right up to the altar. And there I said, Lord, I understand increasingly why you were always on the move. When things got tough, he just quietly moved through them and was gone. And I've taken him to task about this a number of times, saying, that was all very well for you, I'm stuck here. But yes, I am stuck there, and it is my family, and I have to deal with it. And that's the value of it, is that I have to grow through dealing with it. And so I think that a community of faith has a particular value beyond the question of rights and so forth and communal worship. Well, now that, here I was going to let you discuss, and I've been answering your questions. You got 5 minutes. but I will give you time this afternoon. But Dan, do you have a question now?
Yeah. How would you move these church archetypes out into daily life? People complain that people go to church and then they go to their office and they're completely different. How would you move the church and not all these myths? How would you get them out into Sperry Corporation? Not quite a school or, you know, washing dishes.
Well, that's a very good question. That's the question that Brother Lawrence was answering in his little book called Practicing the Presence of God. Have you ever seen that little book? It is available. It's a very old book, but it's reprinted and accessible. I would get that little book. His whole point is that he finds God at least is present in washing the dishes. He speaks specifically about washing the dishes. He's a monk, and he is involved in the kitchen, as it happens. And he's talking about bringing that consciousness into that task, it's written to give you, the reader, advice about how to do that. It's just very beautiful and very simply written. I would suggest that you get that and read that. It's Brother Lawrence. That's the only name he has on it. And it's called Practicing the Presence of God. But your question is very good and very profound. And unless that movement takes place, religion is quite worthless. You can go to church and have a profound experience, but if you can't connect it with the rest of your life, it was not worthwhile.
The Institute of Creation Center Spirituality is a specific group that is working on doing that.
Yes,
and
that's
developing the artist in each person.
Yes.
Unfortunately, at the moment, you have to go to California
for that.
My frustration is it's easier to do that in the secular world than it is in the church.
You don't have to go to California for his ideas, though.
Yeah.
That's Matthew Fox, and you might want to get his book called Original Blessing, which is just delightful. It's a primer of life-oriented theology and brings home to us that this tradition has always been here. Just not stressed by the church. And then he has another book called Western Spirituality, which traces the development. But I would recommend to you particularly Original Blessing. Beyond that, I think that the answer to that question has to be that it's you who has to make that movement. It's you who has to decide what the implications of your faith or your religion are for your daily life. And as you begin your day, and as you end your day, and as you walk through your day, you need to reflect on what those implications are. As you enter into a meeting with another human being, for example, you can remember that person is an individualization of God, and that you will encounter God in that person, whether you find it attractive or not. You know, whether you find that person attractive or not. That God is present in that person, and that you can address yourself to God in that person. You can do this when you're going into a meeting. Be aware that God is the mind of all who are present. You know, there are so many different ways of learning to incarnate your spirituality, because that's what you're talking about. How do I affect the incarnation in my life? How do I bring spirituality down from some kind of abstraction into flesh and blood? How do I bring it to my table where I'm eating my food, to the place where I earn my living, to the way in which I do my maintenance tasks, you know, like shopping and laundry and errands and cleaning the house and doing the yard work and stuff like that? If you just begin the practice of paying attention to what you're doing with your consciousness in each of those things, for example, it dawns on you, you know, as you begin to live more consciously and deliberately, that it's perfectly within your choice to be happy. It's your own choice, you know. What kind of orientation will you have today to your particular life? What will be the thing that you focus on, that you center on in your own consciousness? Those are just hints of ways to begin to incarnate your own value in your life. And the more you do it, the better you'll get at it.
So this seems to me where synchronicity. A lot of even synchronicity. And as you do this, I find as I do this more in my life, other people start doing the same.
Yes. Quite right. Your consciousness is a very potent thing and will affect all kinds of changes around you. You really are in charge of your lives. Completely. All right. We'll see you then at 1:30.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.